on the Frog Hospital, a novel, Like Life, a book of stories, Self-Help, stories, and Anagrams, also a novel. Now, your stories, especially here, have one of the oddest combinations of tones, I think, in recent fiction. And I wondered how you manage the combination that goes from hilarity to rage and from terror to, you know, drawing room comedy almost.
Well, you know, you just pray, I guess. I do feel, I suppose, when I'm in the world of a particular story, that I'm just recording what would be true about that world and what would be true about the emotional life of that world and true to the physical texture and details and psychological reality of that world. So I don't feel it's something artificially, you know, imposed on the story that then has to be juggled. On the other hand, of course, once you feel you've accurately recorded something and you feel there's a kind of tonal mix in there, you have to be careful, obviously, on the second and third and fourth drafts that things are registering and being read the way you intend them to be. But it's all a matter of luck and prayer. But it also, as I'm saying, it's meant to be a kind of accurate record of life and the world.
And it is, but at the same time, there seems to be a good deal of improvisational material also thrown in, a kind of wild comedy that will, for instance, rather than saying there's trouble in the marriage, one of the narrators, I guess, essentially thinks the word trouble, thinks of the Music Man, and the phrase that appears is right here in River City. Mm-hmm. So instead of using the word trouble, she's suddenly bisociating with a song, as characters mm-hmm. frequently do in your fiction, and the song becomes a kind of pun. Mm-hmm. She can't say that there's trouble in her marriage, but she can think of a song about trouble.
Mm. That's very astute of you. There is, I suppose, a kind of theatricality that runs through the narratives. I mean, there's a kind of theatrical impulse or a kind of selecting out of things in order to heighten certain moments or feelings or ideas. Yeah, that particular moment in Who Will Run the Frog Hospital is a moment that is introducing a couple in Paris. And for some reason, I thought at the time it was wildly funny to refer to Paris as River City because, of course, it has a big river running through. And so I do have a slight tendency to get attached to various sillinesses, and I do have to be careful about that. As I was saying to someone yesterday, I don't represent the highest standard in terms of humor. I find almost everything wildly funny, so I have to be careful.
Well, what's marvelous is that the sentences are so well turned that it's almost 3 seconds after you complete them that you realize that there's one hilarious word that has just sort of pinged and resonated outside the sentence and then popped back in. For instance, another man contemplating a series of failures. He's at a party. He thinks for some reason, having seen someone's green shoes, of Peter Pan. And he thinks of an adult kind of Peter Pan party in which everyone will celebrate finally by jumping out the window. Of course, this is his way of thinking about suicide.
Right, right. And then he makes a little pun about never, never land.
You know? Right.
Can one never, never land if one throws oneself out the window? This, you know, it's all part of the associative work and the improvisation, I suppose, of narrative. On the other hand, I suppose as you're concentrating, you do feel again that somehow this is a record of what your characters really would be feeling and you know, experiencing. It's, you know, it's just a leap of faith, I suppose, for the author. But
yes, but at the same time, Anagrams is one of those books that in a way defines the second side. There's the natural world, and then there's the free associative one that runs side by side in the novel and creates a structure of its own. And what's amazing is that the stories can be so grim on the one hand and terrifying and so funny on the other without tripping themselves up. It's almost as if, as you mention in the story in Birds of America, which won every short story prize this year, the narrator has something different to do than the character in the story. And the narrator is constantly capable of poking fun or being harsh in a way that the character cannot, who is entoiled in the story. And in that story, people like that are the only people here. It's particularly devastating because the narrator who wants to be having a better time is the same person, it seems, who's caught in this terrifying story itself.
Yeah. There is a moment in that story where the story talks about the narrator as being separate from the character, in that the narrator is capable of a voice and of speaking sort of unspeakable things. And I suppose to some extent that there is that separation always in narrative, that separation between what would actually be lived and then what can actually be said. And that separation is or that little zone in between is where writers live, and they take that journey and they live in that little zone, and they construct their stories as they travel back and forth within that place. And certainly that story had that idea very much on its mind as it was being written. I use the passive voice as if it were someone else entirely writing it, but...
Well, it's interesting because as the stories have appeared in The New Yorker, many stories have caused me to say, I don't suppose that's true, whereas that story made me say, oh, I hope this isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it carried a weight of ferocity and intensity that made it the most demanding, harrowing, and brilliant of the stories so far. Is there a moment that you know that something has crossed over an edge? Because it seems that story like an enormous effort, whether it's true or not, to convey the panic that contains both really brilliant misanthropic humor and abject helplessness all at the same time.
That story, I guess because it was a sort of not an organized response to something in real life, but a somewhat disorganized response to something that really happened to me and my family and in the world, had a lot of, you know, emotional fuel behind it. And that story, and I think maybe there are maybe one or two other stories in the collection that have a certain kind of raw propulsion in the narrative. And in that way, you feel yourself in the company of the characters, of course, transgressing certain things and able to go places and do anywhere as a kind of almost as a kind of trespass, I think. There's a story called Real Estate in here that where the narrative actually sort of lets out a 2.5-page scream, which is just a bunch of ha ha ha's. It starts off as a laugh and of course is a kind of scream at the start of the story. And when you're feeling a character's emotional life in that way, in this kind of raw way, it's a kind of permission, I suppose, you give the narrative, and then you choose later on whether to keep the journey the narrative has gone on or pull it back and make it do something else.
The mother in People Like That Are the Only People Here is a writer, and she explains to her husband, who has asked her to start to take notes as their child is discovered, their infant child is discovered to have a tumor on her kidney, that the short story, the husband thinks, or the report, or the journalism, may pay for the operation. And there's a grim humor running throughout of the woman who does not want to be able to be an outside observer to this particular event and is surrounded by outside observers in the hospital speaking all kinds of what the story calls canonical babbling. Jamaica Kincaid once told me about her story, her novella, My Brother, that the events in her life that led her to be able to write such a good book were so harrowing that she hopes to never have to write such a good book again. Life and story writing in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, to that extent, the book that you're writing, the narrative that you're writing, the story that you're writing is something of a helpless act. And God knows you would, you know, stories are responses to life and to the world. And a writer is in the habit of, you know, making those narrative responses. But God knows you would never choose art over life. I mean, you would never choose a harrowing event in your life in order to write about it, God knows. I mean, that's just madness. Nonetheless, as a writer, you feel sometimes when things happen to you that there's a certain obligation to honestly respond to what you know and what has happened to you. And if you are a writer and you have the habit of writing, you will sometimes find yourself embarked on sort of helpless journeys. I mean, there's, in a way, you have no choice. I mean, I don't know how Jamaica Kincaid feels, but I'm sure there was a certain kind of helplessness in the act of her writing that book as well. I mean, you have no choice. Here you go. And to some extent, that story that we're talking about, it was like that for me as well.
I'm speaking to Laurie Moore. The occasion is the collection, her recent collection of short story, Birds of America. It's part of what led me to perhaps an overarching and presumptuous idea about your writing, that there is a kind of relation between foreground and background. In the recent novel, Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, it looks like in the background is a story of two girls. At least it's the flashback story. We don't hear very much about this girl who's telling the story, who's now grown up, Barry, at first. But we gradually come to understand that it is her marriage, the likelihood that it's going to disappear, much as her early childhood friend had disappeared. In that background, there's a picture that they've drawn of wounded frogs with splints and bandages over an eye, and the picture even appears in the front of the book. But at the same time, the woman is in France, her husband is a doctor. There's a question about the future of the institute where he's studying. So the title becomes literal. Who will run the frog hospital? Frog as in Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
And will this man stay behind while the wife comes to America? It's never said directly. Mm-hmm. And yet that seems to be the unspoken version of the story that we're really reading.
Hmm. I guess when I put all these different layers together, I'm not choosing myself, and perhaps wouldn't ask a reader to choose a particular meaning, but certainly that meaning is there, and you're very perceptive to note that. It is, you know, the primary story of in that novel is about the adolescent girls. I mean, it's a kind of proto-romance that this particular woman is recalling in the context of her own marriage sort of probably breaking up. But, I mean, again, I don't, you know, the, when one is making a narrative, and obviously the narrative is going back and forth between foreground and background and going back and forth in time as well. I mean, I don't necessarily mean to privilege or give preference to any one particular place. I mean, the narrative is meant to include everything.
Well, I think that it's what leads me to the feeling about the surface of these stories. I think that both of the stories, in a way, are talking about the same thing, whether it's the disappearance from a life of a childhood friend or the disappearance from a marriage of the husband. It's about disappearance, about loss, about anticipating it, about the lengths you go to for another person. And similarly, in Birds of America, in the story Real Estate, you're given in its opening section the information that the character, I think it's Ruth,
mm-hmm.
Has had cancer, which is in remission, as a kind of project to shore up their failing marriage. They are going to get a new house. They find a farmhouse, and plagues immediately follow, squirrels, bats. It turns out that a child is secretly living in the attic, and he invites other children to a hilarious impromptu party. But always the subject, wherever we turn, is infestation of the body, of the house.
Right.
And so the surface of the story seems to be more like a poem where one isn't distinguishing between different levels of metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that very much is a story about infestation and the impossibility of possessing anything. I mean, she can't really hold on or own her marriage or her body. I mean, the most basic things that one would think would be your own, obviously, are not. I mean, it's the chaos of the world, intrudes. You know, there's a story in Like Life, which also has a kind of, you know, real estate breaking down kind of thing. There's a story called Vici d'Arte where someone is dealing with the plagues that obviously have been set upon his apartment. That kind of chaos is narratively very interesting to me, and unfortunately has also had its correlative in my own life with the various apartments and houses that I've been in. So I've been interested in trying to think about what that means for a particular character.
In a review of Anne Beattie's recent collected stories, you spoke about Anne Beattie as being the first chronicler of the dissolution of marriages, of divorces, and
I think I spoke about her as being the first one who took it for granted, assumed it, did not make sentimental tragedy of it, but in fact understood it as a societal norm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I've probably gone out on a limb to say that, but I still would say that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, do you think that that successful writing requires that the writer recognize something about the culture? In other words, like Beattie's writing, she too has an enormously playful sense scampering through her sentences, and yet the deeper tone is of melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems as if it's sort of as particular as it becomes, it's as if you've posited it as the bottomless melancholy of the culture she's describing.
Hmm.
Is that a requirement?
I don't think so. I mean, it's not a requirement that you consciously sort of need to fashion for yourself. I do think that short stories have much in common with songs, which also have that interplay between some kind of melancholy truth or fact and some other idea of language attempting to rise above or fall into that particular emotion. And I think that tonally or temperamentally or emotionally, short stories will have that kind of mix back and forth. I think often when one is writing, one can look back over the years and see that one has responded to certain things. But I don't know that as a writer that you sit down and say, now I am going to respond to this over the next 10 years. Certainly you do say, I am interested in this and how might a particular character live through a certain event if the event went this way. But to sort of set yourself up as a chronicler of a certain thing, I don't think most writers do that. But, you know, 10, 15 years go by and you have de facto sort of chronicled something. But that's, these things you discover after the fact, I think.
I'm very interested in what you say about song. I love American song, and I think in some perverse way, so do you. There's a...
Is that so perverse?
Oh, no, I think the way in which you do it is perverse. Mm-hmm. There's a killer, or at least... he doesn't kill. He's a burglar. He asks the people he's tied up when he removes their gags. He asks them to sing for him. They sing Chattanooga Choo Choo and You Are My Lucky Star. Mm-hmm. And he comes to realize that he is collecting a songbook of people in panic. Your comment about songs is very interesting to me. I think it's quite true that the songwriter capturing a certain emotion at the ground level is also, because of rhyme, alliteration, puns, jokes, even the sprightliness of the music, doing something else at the same time. I think it's very accurate in the description of what you do. Can you give an example of a song that does that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Chattanooga Choo Choo, since you just mentioned it, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's full of the melancholy of lovers being separated. Chattanooga Choo Choo, won't you choo choo me home? I mean, someone's going to be waiting. There's going to be a certain party at the station. I mean, but it's full of separation and sadness and someone who's very far away from home. And yet, that's a very bouncy melody and it's, you know, when you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar. I mean, it's got... It's got a kind of jazzy, you know, optimism to it as well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely, you know, it's fascinating to me because I've never thought of this way of explaining it before, but it's almost as if what you're describing is a different way of thinking about the classical technique of the Chekhov or the Hemingway story, that the received wisdom is that the real subject of the story is what's not spoken of.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're suggesting here is that somehow the attention to the craft of the story is what allows the unspoken thing to rise up. It's almost like thinking of clever lyrics or brilliant rhymes or terrific ways of presenting the material so that the underneath emotion, the sadness, wells up instead of clots.
Right. I suppose if you just sat on that melancholy and just tried to make it, tried to whip it into expression, it would elude you or paralyze the story in some way and fail to express itself properly. And it would also give a lie, I think, to the interplay between melancholy and its opposite that is going on constantly in any character and any person's life. I do think songs have that same kind of conversation back and forth that stories do.
Well, what it makes me think is that the writer, or that you as a writer, are in the same position in a way as your characters. They're frequently in such situations of pain and tenuousness that really the best thing they can do would be to think of the lyrics of a song. It will displace them, at least for a moment, from the ongoing agony of their situation. And it's almost as if the writing, too, glances directly at a horrible truth and then needs to step back from it and then go in again, as if there's almost like a spiral between the narrator's ability to speak of the sadness and the character's ability to accept it, that this is the kind of dance of pain that occupies the stories.
Right, right. I suppose that's just true to human nature, that there's a kind of aversion, you know, there's a kind of approach and then avoidance kind of thing going on. And it's a quality of gingerliness, I guess. Is that the right word? that you move delicately towards something, but then perhaps away, but then perhaps toward again, in order to investigate it properly. It's a kind of animal quality too, isn't it? That animals investigate with a certain tentativeness. So I think that's what, I mean, if you think of a story as an investigation as well as a response, which I think a story is, it would necessarily have a kind of back and forth movement.
I've been speaking to Laurie Moore. The occasion is her newest book of short stories, Birds of America. And thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.